Two Mondays ago, I gave a talk here on contentment and the important role that contentment has in Buddhist practice. And then last week, I gave a talk on joy and the important place of joy in practice. And in a sense, the teachings of the Buddha, the path the Buddha taught, is built on a foundation of contentment and joy, or kind of happiness or sense of well-being. And it's a little bit of a paradox, because people often come to practice because of lack of well-being, and then they're told, well, first you have to have well-being to be here. What it is that we practice the best we can, our practice, but it's important to appreciate the value of a sense of well-being, of contentment, of joy, of happiness, and to live a life that supports the presence of these good qualities. And for some people, that means changing their life a little bit, so that their life, or a lot for some people, so the way they live their lives is conducive for the presence of joy and happiness. If a person's living a very, very hectic, furious life that's filled with greed and hate and confusion, and because they're doing too much, or they are doing too many greedy activities, and they want to try practicing Dharma practice, they're not going to have much success. You're kind of in this fog of greed or fog of tremendous busyness, and the kind of possibilities of well-being, the possibilities of contentment, or some sense of spiritual dimension of life, doesn't have a chance to kind of get in or to arise. So to begin appreciating these qualities and to look for how to develop them in our lives is very important. And partly it's important because the deeper work of Dharma practice is supported by these qualities. The deeper work of Dharma practice is often quite challenging. Sometimes it's very frightening. From a conventional point of view, can seem very very threatening or very uncomfortable. And the threatening aspects of Dharma practice, or the uncomfortable aspects of them, are a lot easier to handle or work with if there's a fair amount of joy and happiness to carry you through them at the same time. And they often go hand in hand. So some of the more deeper threatening or deeper challenging aspects of practice don't arise unless you have that sense of well-being first. And so kind of you don't have to worry about not having it, because usually it comes first anyway. And the most the challenging aspect of practice is when we start encountering the Dharma, when we start seeing the Dharma. It's the joy and contentment which allows us to have an experience of the Dharma in its depths. It's said sometimes in the tradition that there are three ways that we relate to the Dharma in the course of practice. The first is that we learn about the Dharma, or we know about it. So you can read a book or something, hear some talks, and you have somewhat of intellectual or understanding of what the Dharma is. The second, and the Dharma has a lot of different meanings in Buddhism, but it could very simply mean the truth, the way things are, the depth of the truth, the deep insights that are synonymous with realization. So first we kind of know about it. And then the next is to see it, to see the Dharma. And knowing and seeing are quite different, as reading a menu is quite different from eating the food. So reading a book about Buddhism is quite different than actually tasting or seeing what is actually being talked about. To actually see for yourself, aha, now I know. I know for myself, I've seen this. It actually makes sense. It's like I actually see how it works. I see this insight. I see the truth. Then the third phase of practice is being the Dharma. So not just simply seeing it, but becoming it. And that sometimes is both seeing it and becoming it can sometimes be a big challenge. And it can seem like a huge endeavor. To see it is one thing, and to become it is something else. And part of the reason why it's a big endeavor, or why it can be challenging, or at times terrifying for some people, it often works as a direct challenge to our sense of self, to who we think we are. And many of us hold on to our sense of self, our conventional happiness or well-being or security in life is often tied up in the sense of who we think we are and who we're trying to be and who we're trying to present ourselves as to the world or represent ourselves to as. We are who we are in a sense, and then we're always representing ourselves as something else. And then we hold on to the representation. And we don't show ourselves fully. We hold back aspects of who we are because we're afraid. They knew that about me, they wouldn't like me. Or we present something totally different. We try to put on a good face or be smart or kind in a way that's not really who we are. So there's a whole dynamic around what can be called selfing in Buddhism, creating a self, being attached to a sense of self, that needs to be addressed in practice, because the whole enterprise of selfing is stress-producing, is stress-reinforcing, is a condition for deeper and deeper suffering. And so if we want to kind of relax deeply in meditation or in our lives as deeply as possible, that aspect of life which is stress-producing, which is tight or tense or causes suffering, has to be let go of. And it turns out that the selfing that we often live by is stressful and tense-producing. And it might not be producing suffering immediately. In fact, you know, you might actually feel some happiness. Someone praises you. Boy, you did a great job. You say, well, wow, you know, suddenly you're puffed up. And it's great, right? You feel a certain kind of happiness. But there's a certain kind of happiness that can come from, for example, being praised or being too filled with oneself that is very fragile and is a setup for suffering in the future. Once we have that praise, then it might be very difficult to do without it in the future. Then tomorrow they blame you, you know, and then what happened? You know, they're disoriented. How could they have switched so fast? And there's a quote by the Buddha where he says something like, it's an ancient truth, or it's been true ever since ancient times. There is no person who... There's no one who is ever freed of being blamed. They'll blame you if you talk too much. They'll blame you if you talk too little. And they blame you if you talk just the right amount. No one is free of blame. So when I read that, I had a little teeny, you know, liberation. You know, and the attempts to try to set myself up so I would never be blamed. I realized it was hopeless. One of the ways that I tried to present myself that I became painfully aware of was my neurosis about wanting to be liked. And I remember working in a kitchen where I was kind of the kitchen foreman and kitchen manager. And it was not a place, you know, where wanting to be liked was very relevant. I mean, the food had to be out. You know, you had this thing that had to happen. And if I spent did a lot of gymnastics, social gymnastics, to ensure that everybody in the kitchen liked me, it was very complicated and difficult, and the food didn't come out in time. So it was very clear, you know. So I got to see over and over again this, you know, this tremendous gymnastics I was doing and trying to kind of say things certain ways and get people to like me. And it's good for people to like you, to like us, right? It's not but to do this mental gymnastics and try to be who you're not and try to be overly protective of them or try to avoid the truth by saying things really nicely, you know. No one should have to live that way. So sooner or later, Dharma practice challenges us in this whole area of selfing, how we relate to the self, what we think the self is. And the teachings of the Buddha are over and over again point to this in ways that can be seen as very challenging. It's one of the common refrains in the Buddha's teachings is a little kind of triplet, three statements that come to go together. He's referring to different things. And different times he refers to different things in our experience. Sometimes he talks about our body. Sometimes he talks about the mind, sometimes consciousness. Sometimes our different sense organs, eyes and ears. Sometimes our feelings, sometimes our thoughts and dispositions, our intentions, our feelings. He talks about these different things, and then he says, these are not... don't take these as being mine, as being me, and as being myself. These are not mine, they're not me, and they're not myself. So kind of this little triplet, three statements. Me, myself, and mine. But he did it me. Mine, me, myself. You know, his English wasn't that good. And and what is what this points to is three movements, what was called in the tradition grips, that the way we grip, the mind is gripped or gripping to things. The first one has to do with the grip of greed or possessiveness. This is mine. So, you know, my car is mine, my money is mine, my house is mine. My clothes are mine. We had a mine incident this weekend at Spirit Rock, where I went with my son to the family retreat. And it's like, you know, it's a great thing. You know, it's this beautiful, beautiful state-of-the-art meditation center that's I've gone to for many years. You sit in great silence, and no one talks, and just perceive everybody's walking very mindfully and quietly and serenely all the time. Just great. Except for the family retreat. And it was wild. But in any case, my son was very happy to be there, and we got there a little bit early enough for him to get a front row seat in the meditation hall. And for 3 days, or two and a half days or something, we had our seat, and we had a little handwritten sign that said reserved on it. And then we came in one morning, and there was another six-year-old sitting on the seat and his parent. Oops. Those are our seats. We own them. We possess them. We claim them. They are ours. They are, you know. We had made them mine. A movement of selfing had occurred. There was no inherent possessive to that place or those cushions. They didn't, you know, have our, you know, our names on it, because I had the reserve sign. But I mean, we made them self. We made them we claimed them. It was a mental activity. These are mine, and we were living in that mine. And in that living in that mine, these are mine. These are ours. Then we had to deal with other people's ideas about whose those were. And that six-year-old had a very different idea. He didn't understand about mine. And he just saw that they're empty. He couldn't read. And so what to do? Now, as a grown-up Buddhist, I had the capacity, I hope, of saying, it's okay, you can have those seats. We've been in the front long enough, we'll take a seat further back. But I was with a six-year-old, my son. And I had to figure out, you know, what was best given everybody's situation. And for my son, he had big-time selfing around his seat. And I did not feel that this was a time to teach him a lesson in letting go of mine. It just didn't seem appropriate. It seemed like it actually caused more damage than good. And it seemed like it was easier just to explain to these people that we'd been, you know, very carefully been sitting there And, you know, we had our reserved sign there. And then afterwards, later they left, kind of gracefully left. Afterwards, I went up to the woman and said, you know, thank you. And I explained the situation. She explained her situation, but it was kind of complicated. And then I said, oh, and by the way, there were other seats nearby. And she was, I gave her some, you know, front row seats nearby that were empty. So it was, ended up well. But, you know, selfing happened right there. You see, 6-year-old, you know, and a grown-up, and people are all selfing. And it's an optional thing. But, you know, there was a lot of complexity around it because of the delicate nature of self. So, you know, we make things into mine. As I like to say sometimes here, if we went home tonight with different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. You know, it's all about selfing. You know, you've made, these are my shoes. You know, when I used to wear Birkenstocks a lot, sometimes I would go home with different Birkenstocks. Mm-hmm. And once, yeah, I usually am the last one to leave, right? So it was never my problem. And sometimes I go home with different Birkenstocks. I'd wonder, will I ever get my original ones back? And once I didn't. I wore the other ones, you know, to nothing. They wore out. I love the quote by Suzuki Roshi. And there's a photograph of him actually saying this. I kind of coincidentally took a picture of him at the same time. He held up his glasses and he went like this. These are not my glasses. But you know about my tired old eyes. So you allow me to use them. That's a different attitude about, you know, something that he was his in a sense. So kind of much holding it much more lightly, you know, the idea of possession. So I suspect that all of us, probably to a small or great degree, are very much actively involved in the business of selfing, around claiming things as mine. These are mine. And then the question is that a setup for you to suffer, or do you have the freedom and the grace to just, when circumstances change, say, well, okay, you know, that's too bad, or I'll have to do something about this, or maybe I'll have to say something to someone, or try to protect it, or do something, take good care of it. But we're not, our ego is not tied to it. The way we don't suffer because of, you know, the fragile nature of possessiveness, possessions. It's very fragile, the idea of possession. As my friend said, well, she didn't say this, but experienced when she came home after going to Stinson Beach to the beach, and all she had with her was her car keys and driver's license, and she came back and her house, which was also her office in the Oakland Hills, was no longer there because she was burned in the Oakland fire. So my house, my ashes. You know, things can change very quickly. So then what is our relationship to things we say are mine? And do we hold on to these things in a way that's going to cause us suffering? Or do we hold them in a way that, you know, doesn't cause the same level of suffering? Is our life dependent on it? Is our deep sense of well-being, our deep inner sense of happiness, dependent on the presence of these things we call mine? So the Buddha was much more challenging, just saying that our possessions are not ours. Oh, at this family retreat, you know Betsy Rose? She's a singer, she's a Buddhist singer, and she's great. She'll come down here one day and do a musical Dharma talk for us. But she did this beautiful kind of solo song where she sang the chapter, the poem on children by in the Prophet. And it starts off, your children are not your children. It was so moving, you know, it's family retreat, singing to all the parents. Your children are not your children. Well, who are they then? They're not your children. They come through you, but they don't belong to you. You cannot give them your thoughts. You cannot give them your thoughts. You can only give them your love. You cannot make them become like you. You can only try to shape yourself to become like them. Something like that. It's done poetically, right, in the poem. So the Buddha was much more challenging, just possessions, but he also said, our thoughts are not something that we can take as mine. Our feelings are not mine. Our body is not mine. Our eyes, our nose, our ears, our hair. One of the reasons why Buddhist monastics shave their hair is because so much selfing goes into our hair. Oh, my hair, you know. Doesn't even my six-year-old is concerned about his hair. The thing he's really concerned about is milk mustaches. He does not want his other friends to see that he has milk mustache. I don't know what's gotten into him, but you know, it's happened. And it's mortifying to have a milk mustache in front of other six-year-olds. So this idea, you know, and consciousness is not self. Is not something to take as mine, my consciousness. And so basically the Buddha said that our whole psychophysical being is not to be taken as a possession, as mine. This is mine to own or possess. And that's very challenging. And then the question is this reasonable even to have this attitude? Of course this is my body, you know, until, you know, you have hip replacement. Or, you know, my sister has two other people's kidneys in her body. She has four kidneys. Whose kidneys are they now? You know, these extra kidneys. Are they hers? Is she borrowing them? And things change, you know. So, you know, how do we relate to this body? Some people give up their kidneys quite freely. One person gave it up freely. One was a cadaver kidney. And you know, giving these things up. What would you give up? We hold on to certain things, you know, until maybe a loved one is in trouble, and then we're willing to give up certain parts of our bodies we think is mine. And then consciousness is not something we possess. My wife, some many years ago, had to go through for 3 months medically induced menopause. And we'll see if it's going to be like how menopause is for her, you know, when she really goes through it. But she went through this medically induced menopause, and she had hot flashes and all these symptoms sometimes, I guess, happen in menopause. And she said to me, going through, she said, you know, this is bizarre. I'm having all these thoughts, but these are not my thoughts. And she had the wisdom not to identify with her thoughts, maybe because they were so different than what you usually are. And she went, well, these are not my thoughts. Or when I was 14, my father took me aside and said to me, which I've said many times, I apologize for repeating. And he said, as you're growing up, you're going to have a lot of bizarre thoughts. And he said, everyone has those. Don't worry about it. And that saved me a lot of grief. Because guess what? I had, you know, periodically bizarre thoughts. And I thought, oh, I've been warned. Oh, this happens to human beings. So I didn't take it too personally. I didn't, oh, this is mine. So it kind of freed me up. The next, so that's, you know, the issue of taking things as mine. The next one is, which has to do with greed, the movement to greed or holding on or possessiveness, that movement of the mind. And the second is that of seeing things as me. And this is understood in tradition as being the kind of grip of conceit. And conceit is a very powerful force in human psyche. And this has a lot to do with taking some things to use as defining, this is who I am, often in comparison to others, other people. I'm better, I'm worse, I'm equal to. I'm good, I'm bad in relation to others. It often has to do with a sense of self-worth or value. I'm valuable and worthy because I am X. Because I am... You fill in the blank. You know, for each of us probably has some kind of boogeyman that we fill in there in that blank. Because I am, therefore I am great, or therefore I am lousy. Because, you know. And our sense of self-worth is often tied then to this, we fill in. I am, this is who, this defines who I am. My work defines who I am. So I'm whatever. I'm a carpenter, and carpenters are really cool, and you better know that I'm cool, because carpenters are cool, or whatever, you know. Or our sense of who we are comes through who we're related to. So you know, our spouse. Our spouse is someone, therefore we're someone. Or, you know, our parents. I see it in my little son. He's kind of proud of me. He thinks it's good to be a Dharma teacher. And so he's kind of proud of people listen to me, you know. So for the time being, I'm cool in his eyes. And I think he gets a little bit of, you know, sense of self because he's borrowed for, you know, from what he thinks I am. And our accomplishments, what we've done in the past, and people hold on to it for a long time. It's very important that people see who we are. And so we can spend a lot of time, some people can spend a lot of time talking, explaining, demonstrating themselves to show everybody else who we are. It's very important other people see us as who we want to be. And this has to do with this idea of conceit and the grip of conceit. And for some people, it's very, very powerful. And it causes tremendous grief. Partly because it's not a very reliable thing to hold on to. Any kind of conceit, any kind of grip of conceit, holding on to something, this is who I am, is probably going to change at some point. And it takes a lot of work then to maintain an old identity, old idea of who we are. The further it goes away, if we hold on to some accomplishment, and this is really important, this accomplishment, to define who I am, and the further back in time that goes into the past, the more effort has to be made to remind yourself of that, or to remind other people of that. Let me tell you that story of when I, because otherwise how would people know it unless you told them or reminded them? So the grip of conceit is very, very fragile, causes tremendous suffering. The third thing is, this is not myself. And this is not myself, in Buddhism, is said to be the grip of views. And this is very important for many people to understand, since the idea of not self is very central to Buddhism. It's very important to see that this actually, the teaching of not self, belongs to views. It's the views or the philosophy or the story we tell ourselves about what the self is. It's a little bit different than conceit, because it's more of a view. It's more of a philosophy. So we have a view or a philosophy or that the self is eternal, or the self is one with nature, or the self is independent from everything else, or the self is the same as the body, or the self is different than the body, or the self is the same as thoughts, or the self is the same as our feelings, or the self is the same as our intuition, or the self is the same as our intellect, or the self is the same as our intentions, or the self is the same as our, you know, it's kind of a view of understanding who we think we are. And we're not using it to hold up our sense of worth, like as we would when conceit, or using it to compare to someone else. But it's a deep view that this is who I really am. My true nature, my true self, I found it. Or this must be what it is. We have a view of it. Now that I think I know what it is, I have to find it, or I have to hold on to it, or I have to get everything else out of the way to experience this is the true self. And what the Buddha said over and over again is that nothing whatsoever that we can experience, that's an experiential world, qualifies as a reliable self, something we can hold our philosophical hat on. This is who I really am. So not our body, not our consciousness, not our thoughts, you know, nothing. Then the question is, well, how about something that's outside of experience? And the Buddha didn't answer that question. No one ever asked him that question, I think. But I think what he would have said was, well, then it's not relevant. that doesn't really pertain then. If it's completely outside of experience, nothing, you can't have any relationship to it because you can't experience it or see it or know it or act on it or have it act on you. So three grips of self. The grip of possessiveness, the grip of conceit, and the grip of views. And both of them are very, very powerful in the human psyche. All three of them are powerful in the human psyche, and all three of them take effort, take work to maintain. and mental work, mental effort. You don't say a possessiveness doesn't exist without our mind creating idea. These are my shoes, or someone. The idea of conceit doesn't happen unless the mind makes the effort to compare ourselves with others and to value, be caught up in the world of valuing. And the mind doesn't have a philosophical view without having a philosophical view, without making the work to have that view and hold it somewhere. Maybe it's in the back corners of the mind, kind of on a shelf, quietly for the most part. But it's still active. It's still kind of there. It takes energy for it to be there and to operate. And the kind of effort and energy it takes is considered in Buddhism to be stressful, to be agitating, to be painful. Though most of the time, the degree to which it's painful or agitating or stressful is so subtle that we wouldn't necessarily see it. But it's kind of this underlying foundation of suffering going on that's supporting a whole cathedral, a whole edifice of selfing that's built on these three foundations. And the foundations themselves are suffering, unstable, unsatisfactory. As the mind gets more settled on itself, as the mind, as we get more peaceful or more trusting and begin letting go in more and more deeper way, letting go of the suffering, letting go of the extra activity of the mind, which is burdensome, the stressful activities, and the mind gets stiller and stiller, or more and more relaxed, more open, or more peaceful, or more spacious, or more empty, or whatever kind of language you like to use, sooner or later, for many people, encounters this interface with the process of selfing. And partly why it's so difficult for some people is that the attachment to selfing is so strong. And our sense of security and well-being is so tied up with this thing of selfing. The fact that it's important for us to have, you know, a particular job or a particular house or a particular bank account that has a certain amount of money in it or particular relationships, that all have to do with a sense of selfing, me, myself, and mine. I'm a little bit confused. A lot of things we're attached to or think are very important are built on this deeper foundation of selfing. I guess I'm kind of muddled right now in my what I'm trying to say. Can we just erase that, or can we start over again? Or what do you do when you get confused and keep talking? So the challenge is to, as the mind gets more peaceful and settled, is we're challenged to look at this idea of selfing. It becomes very, very important. And then what does it take to take a leap and move beyond that into the letting go of that selfing? How to rest in our hearts, or rest in our minds, rest in being, in beingness in a sense, without having to do any kind of selfing at all, without needing to have a view of who we are, without seeing anything through the filter of this is who I am. Even the view that this is happening to me, the idea this is happening to me is in a funny way a view. It's happening to you. Many things are happening to you. So it's not erroneous to say it's happening to me. But to form the idea in your mind, this is happening to me, is one step extra from just having it happen. You see a sunset. It's a beautiful sunset. This sunset is happening to me. This sunset, I'm the one who's experiencing the sunset. Isn't this great? It's really happening to me. It's happening in my eyes. It's happening in my mind. It's really wonderful it's happening to me. How much are you enjoying the sunset when all that activity goes on? I think it disconnects you from the sunset a little bit, doesn't it? So, usually we don't relate that actively with selfing around sunsets, but it's happening at a subtle level. So can we let go of that and just let the sunset be there, and in a sense, without it happening to anybody? It doesn't mean you don't have the experience of the sunset, but you don't formulate the idea, this is happening to me. Just experience happening through us. So the third step of Dharma practice, the idea of becoming the Dharma, has a lot to do with letting go, relaxing, having a phenomenal deep trust where it's okay not to have any kind of selfing going on at all, to put all that to rest. And it's one thing to go into, for example, some deep experience, spiritual experience, and really see, really let go of self for a moment, or for a short time, or for a period of time, and to feel this is really right. Wow, I see it, it's possible. And it's another thing then to live that way, to become the Dharma. And so, you know, part of the value of deep practice is to show us what the work is of learning to let go and rest in this deeper sense of trust or beingness or Dharma, where there doesn't have to be any kind of self-referential constructions going on around it at all. So a lot of Dharma teachers will then emphasize that really key to Dharma practice is not attaining anything in practice, but rather it's letting go. You're not attaining some great states or great experience. And, you know, once I attain this great enlightenment, the great masters talk about this great big bang experience of enlightenment, when I get that big bang, then I'll be okay. Then I'll be a worthy person. Then I really, you know, have something great. You know, my enlightenment, thank you. And I'll be the greatest guy in my block. It'd be really great to go out in the block and show my neighbors, you know, how good I am. I'm enlightened. And it's really going to be me. I don't really know who I am when I really have that enlightenment. Then I really, it's me. So rather than saying, Buddhist spirituality in terms of attainments, it's much more common to talk about it as a process of letting go. It's not about acquiring or getting anything, but rather just letting go. Letting go. And the Dharma that we can know, that we can see, and we can become, is present right here, right now. It's ever present. It's ever with us. It's nowhere else. It can be nowhere else, but right here, in us, with us, all around us. Can we let go? Can we relax? Can we trust enough to allow the Dharma, the truth, the way things are, to just be us? Or just be. There's no us anymore. So that's the challenge. And it's best to accept that challenge once you've done the work to in figuring out how to establish a modicum or a fair amount of contentment and joy in your life. And once you have that, then we can talk about the big challenge. So I hope that was clear enough. Apologize for the muddleness. And may you all be the Dharma.